You should start.
You're gonna be back. I can call this meeting to order. Any announcements?
We do have one.
Two.
Two.
I have an announcement. The meetings are, the minutes are going to be corrected. The chair was misnoted, so that is being corrected.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Old template, sorry. We'll get it right.
I thought it was being removed.
You have not been demoted.
Which I might be open to.
And then secondly, we finalized contract negotiations with AQR, and we're looking to fund that strategy, the risk parity strategy, on March 7th.
Are there any public comments? Anyone from the public here?
Roll call, please.
Can we do a roll call first?
Or at least, yeah.
Can we do a roll call?
Thank you. Donna Riley?
Here.
Jim DeMartini?
Here.
Jeff Grover?
Here.
Sam Sharp?
Here.
Mandeep Dillon?
Here.
Mike Lynch?
Here.
Darren Garrett?
Present.
Lauren Klein?
Here.
Michael O'Neill? Rhonda Biesmeyer?
Here.
Thank you. We have a quorum.
Change my name.
Thank you. The next item is a consent calendar. Item number five, are there any desires to take any items off consent? Hearing none, do I?
I'll make a motion to approve the consent calendar as noted on the agenda.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded.
It's been well seconded.
Please call the roll. Or can you do that?
Of course.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion carries. Next item is the investment report.
So this is item 6A. It's the real estate allocation. It's a discussion and action item. And staff's recommendation today will be to allocate 2.5% to a dedicated U.S. real estate debt manager to be selected by the Board of Retirement, which we'll do right after this agenda item. Increase the current allocation to the Morgan Stanley Prime Property Fund at 2.5%. Increase the current allocation to American Realty Advisors to 2.5%. Maintain the existing allocation of approximately 0.7% to Greenfield 7. Authorize staff to negotiate and execute the final contract to fund Greenfield 8 for an allocation of approximately 1.8% or $40 million. And then to eliminate the allocation to the BlackRock U.S. Real Estate Fund. And to present this item will be Chris Wisdom, our retirement investment officer.
Okay. Thank you, Rich. So essentially what we're doing here is making a recommendation as how to implement the real estate allocation, something that we've already spoken about at previous meetings. Last year in April, the board approved a 10% real estate allocation. Half was intended to be invested in core real estate, half value added, so 5% and 5%. Later, Verus presented some economic market analysis suggesting that real estate debt would be a good substitute for core real estate. The board discussed this and ended up interviewing two real estate debt managers. And so the action item that the board gave staff and Verus was to do some due diligence on one of those managers, that's Prudential, and then come back for a formal recommendation for the real estate allocation. So that's why we're here. This agenda item concerns the allocation only. So what we are planning to do, we've done the due diligence. We do want to continue with this 10% allocation at the total plan level, half core, half value add, and implement, split core further into core real estate equity and then this debt allocation as well. And perhaps the easiest way to look at this might be to flip to the table shown on the page 3 of the agenda item. What we're recommending is that we end up with approximately $54 million in four managers. Two core managers, two value add. So if you look near the right side of the table, this new allocation column, this is kind of where we're on it, and round numbers. And going down the list, we want to take advantage of the current managers that we currently invest with in the private markets because there's no reason to make a change. They're performing well. The first is Morgan Stanley Prime. That's a core real estate manager. We've got about $18 million with them now. We want to increase that to this $54 million that I mentioned. Okay, so recommendations to give them extra funds. Then we mentioned giving $54 million to a U.S. debt manager. That would be new, and we'll look at that in the next agenda item here. Moving down in the value add category, we've currently got the American Strategic Value Fund, and we're looking just to increase the current allocation there. Up to 54, we've got about $25, $26 million now. Greenfield is a little bit trickier because they are, the current fund is a closed-end fund, so it's it can't take more money. We've got about $14 million there and expect some more to be called, probably up to about $16 million. So what we want to do is then invest in Greenfield 8, the next fund that Greenfield is offering. Staff, Rick and I have conducted calls with Greenfield to discuss this fund. It has largely similar return targets, slightly different sector focus than Greenfield 7, but the recommendation is to put an additional $40 million in Greenfield 8, and again, kind of be in the mid $50 million range with Greenfield. So again, it's half core, half value add. What we are looking to do, to keep going down, you'll see that we do have funds in the BlackRock REIT fund right now. It's a public market real estate fund. What we'd like to get to is to have our real estate investments be private only. So use those four managers that were aforementioned and eventually reduce the allocation to BlackRock REITs to zero.
Hey, Chris, what's the difference between calculated rebalance and recommended rebalance?
Rounding, essentially, only. So it's really just to put a round number on it.
Okay.
The calculated rebalance would get us exactly on target. The recommended is just a cleaner number.
It's a moving number that just changes constantly every day, essentially.
Okay.
Yeah, frankly, it'll change the one we end up implementing. We talk a little bit about the timing here, too, just for just to be aware of. We can't necessarily get into these funds on day one. The closed-end funds will give us capital calls, and we'll give them capital when they're ready to deploy it. The other funds that are open, the Morgan Stanley Prime and American Strategic Value, even they have funding queues. So we can get in the funding queue. I expect this change will take several quarters to complete.
So this, Rick, this essentially implements what the board has discussed and acted on over the last 9 months.
Yes, in April 25th of 2017, the board agreed to the final asset allocation, which included this 10% to real estate. The only difference was in November, Ed brought the idea of splitting the core between value add or between core and real estate debt,
right.
And that was agreed to in November. This is simply the implementation of that strategy that you folks have agreed to.
Okay. Any member comments?
I move approval of the six staff recommendations.
Is there a second?
Second.
It's been moved and seconded to approve this item. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Next item is
item 6B.
B.
So this is a subject is Prudential Real Estate U.S. debt strategy. This is a discussion and action item as well. Staff's recommendation today would be to allocate 2.5%, approximately $54 million, to the PGIM Real Estate U.S. debt strategy, and then authorize staff to negotiate and execute the final contract with Prudential. And Chris will also be presenting this item.
Okay, so this recommendation essentially piggybacks on what we just discussed. Now that we've got an approved allocation to the U.S. Real estate debt strategy, we need to hire a manager, and we're recommending that we hire Prudential for this PGIM real estate fund. Staff and Veris conducted due diligence in late January. We went to New York to visit Prudential's office there. And I think the main takeaway was there were no surprises. This is very much what we were expecting. We met with some of the folks that came out here to meet with you all in November and about 10 or 12 others as well, covering all areas of the firm, investments, research, risk management, met their head of origination, compliance folks. It's a team of very deeply experienced professionals. As a reminder on the strategy, kind of a lower risk, lower volatility strategy within our real estate allocation. These are debt investments secured by properties with stable cash flows, and there's some leverage that's employed here on the lease return investments. So that's something that they spoke with about here as well in the visit. Target return is 7 to 8% gross, a little bit lower than some of our other real estate investments. That does have the potential to increase as interest rates in general increase potentially. So that is the strategy. The staff is going to staff is recommending rather that we begin to negotiate a contract with Prudential. And I should point out that they're offering us a fee discount for a 2-year commitment, offering a discount of 15 basis points compared to the stated fee. So 95 basis points, for example, on the first 50 million, it would drop to 80 basis points. And the schedule is shown in the agenda item later.
Chris, I have a question.
Yes.
Can you comment about what is the founder's fee?
Sure, the founder's fee, so that's the discounted fee that I'm talking about. So initial investors in the fund, of which we would be considered one of, considered founders. That's just a term that they're offering. So it's a discounted fee compared to the regular fee schedule. Every number in this column here would be 15 basis points higher if we were not considered to be founder here, if we wait longer to invest in this.
So we either pay the standard fee or the founder's fee, or do we pay both?
Well, no, we'll pay the founder's fee only.
The founder's fee, yeah. Okay.
The founder's fee is also offered as part of a 2-year lockup. So the commitment is required for that first 2 years, then that lockup goes away after that time frame. And so if you wanted to say we don't like that lockup, then you could pay the higher non-founder's fee rate and not have to deal with that. Given the pension plan dynamics,
lockup is good.
Liquidity is an issue.
Thank you.
I'll make a motion to move the staff recommendation.
Second.
Okay. So moved and seconded to adopt item 6B. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Next item.
Next item.
Which is Ed.
Veris.
Veris.
It's all yours.
I'd just like to bring it to the board's attention that anything Chris has suggested has been approved in a matter of minutes.
what's your point? Sounds like you got something to work on.
Well,
I think you laid the groundwork.
Let's start with the 12-month work plan. I want to make a couple edits to this, just verbally. We show in February here that the last item would be the private markets search launch. That's actually something that staff is going to lead and move to March. And then as a result, I think the April private markets finalist presentations will probably get pushed into the future as well. So I think that's some of the fluid nature of what we're dealing with the investment program overall. And but I think things are generally on track, and this next step of the private markets component is basically the final piece to the FFP construct that we've been working on for 3 years now.
So then in 3 months from now, you'll come back with a whole new idea and we'll be starting all over.
I may. I'm not going to prejudge that. Next item is the flash report for January. A couple noteworthy items here. You see Jackson Square Partners had a decent month, 7.9% versus 7.1% for its benchmark. That's a slight recovery from what we'll see. Fourth quarter performance lagged pretty considerably, and this would be the source of funding for the AQR. So as Chris mentioned earlier, AQR expected to be funded on March 7th. It will be drawn from here. And so we've discussed that termination. Chris, I believe they've received notice as such. Dodge and Cox also had a nice month, 5.7 versus 3.9. That, too, is a nice recovery from fourth quarter. They lagged pretty significantly, and we'll see that in a moment. So this is a bit of a bounce back there. No particular comments for the rest of the portfolio for the month, but continues to shape up well. 1 month return of 2.8, net of fees, and fiscal year to date of 10.2. So nice progression we're seeing there. If we move to the first tab in the book, We have the investment landscape. I'll try to keep this brief. I know you're all paying attention to the markets, and this is as of 12/31, and a few things have happened since then, so we can talk about those up there as well. If you turn to page 3, the fourth quarter summary. I always like to emphasize this page is, if you have 10 seconds to see what we think about the markets, this is it. This is the best 10-second page we can give you. In the lower left-hand corner, I'd highlight that it says markets remain expensive by most measures, and that continues. And so that gives us some pause, both in terms of where do we invest the next dollar, because nothing looks cheap out there. And also our capital markets assumptions, which you'll see in our April meeting, where we take our annual look and forecasting over the next 10 years, all those expected returns have come down. Because the markets have gone up so much so fast, now as we look out into the next 10 years, everything has notched down a bit. So there's no real good safe haven out there. That puts us at some risk in the portfolio, and it's partially to explain what happened at the beginning of February. Some good news on earnings, though, which isn't on this page directly. On the right-hand side, the second point down talks about it a little bit. But now that we've gone through most of the fourth quarter reporting, the S&P 500 companies, we've heard from about 90% of them, and the earnings results are really impressive. So going into the quarter, we expected 11% year-over-year growth, which in and of itself is a pretty strong number. And the actual is coming out more like 15. And so with 90% reporting, 15% earnings growth. And similarly on the revenue side, we're seeing about an 8% growth in revenues. So it is there. Companies are growing and doing well. That's good to see. Part of that is tied to tax plan and the changes, the tax reform that's carried through. But actually in the fourth quarter, a lot of companies took advantage of the tax changes to recognize losses. And so it actually brought down the Dow Jones Industrial Average, their earnings, by about 40%. So it will help their long-term earnings, but they're able to recognize a lot of losses up front. So that's interesting how that's playing out. A couple things I do want to highlight for you is, if we turn to page 9, we have a slide on inflation. And this slide doesn't present anything that's really surprising, but this is exactly what teed up the sell-off earlier this month. And so the expectation was that a lot of the good news coming out about the U.S. economy has been so good that it's been surprisingly good, and that's going to cause inflation. Now, if we take a look at this page and this series of charts, at the bottom left-hand corner, we map out CPI, a widely used index of inflation, and we have it core, which excludes food and energy, because economists apparently don't eat or drive, and overall CPI. And you can see that on the farthest right-hand side, both of those numbers are right around 2%, so nothing particularly interesting there. In the middle, we have a break-even analysis. This is what the bond market is pricing for inflation by looking at 5- and 10-year bonds, inflation-adjusted and non-inflation adjusted, to see what those expectations look like. And again, they haven't changed that much. We're right around the 2% range, plus or minus. And then inflation expectations on the right-hand side, this is survey data for University of Michigan, and we don't see much inflation there either. So what happened, and why would you think something changed? Let's turn the page. The labor market. So here, the labor market has been a key discussion point since the global financial crisis. On the lower left-hand side, we see the unemployment rate continues to tick down very nicely, very methodically, and so now the headline number is right around 4%, and the broader measure, the U6, which includes partially employed and part-time workers and such, has also progressed downward and is about 8%. So, okay, those numbers are looking good, and we're basically back to pre-financial crisis levels, so it's kind of normalized now. In the middle, we're seeing average hourly earnings not responding a whole lot. This is the growth rate in earnings, and you can see that it's been growing right around 2%, plus or minus, but nothing at 3% for some time. This is the concern, though, is that as the labor market tightens, will companies have to pay more to their employees? And if and when that happens, that could be a real sign of inflation, because employees have more money in their pockets, they will spend more money, and it will flow through, and then we will see inflation happen. This is what we've been watching, and this is what the suspicion is, that as we hear comments from ex-Chair Yellen and now Chair Powell, that their optimistic views of the economy are suggesting that these numbers are getting stronger, if they get stronger, they're going to raise rates. And so Powell's discussions today, he was speaking today, being interviewed by Congress, so whatever the right word is for that formalized process they call. He was
showboating. Yeah.
What's that?
Yeah, posturing, showboating.
So he was again giving indications that he's seeing strength, and he has historically not been a hawkish governor, and so we'll see if he becomes hawkish. But one way or another, the bond market interpreted it to mean 4 rate hikes this year. I think lately 3 next year. So we were at 6. Now we're looking at 7. So somewhere in the balance, we're seeing more pressure on rates to go up. And sure enough, they are. So the 10-year is now north of 2.9%. The 2-year has risen more dramatically. The 5-year has risen more dramatically. So we're seeing a flattening of the yield curve. And this is all really interesting. Market participants look at that and say a flat or inverted yield curve suggests recession. Higher real rates suggest recession. If that is to happen, then we can start looking that in the coming years we're going to see something change in our economy.
And a general time frame for that would be?
Anyone's guess. So that
2020?
Perhaps. Part of it is that the short end will rise. And if they do the 7 or 8 yield increases, the rate increases, that will push that up. The question is on the long end, they don't control that. And will the long end respond moving upward as well because the economy continues to do well? So take your money out of treasuries and invest elsewhere. Or do they say, no, long-term treasuries are the best bet, and then you get the inversion issue. So it really depends on what the yield curve does on the long end to play that out. Also, I think Powell kind of reserved some judgment. In his comments, he didn't say 4 rate rises this year. The market interpreted that. It may be the continued data dependency. We'll see what the market gives us, and we'll respond accordingly. I think that's probably the better approach. So.
From a pension plan perspective, are you that concerned about interest rates rising?
No,
I wouldn't be.
Because I want the liabilities to decrease. Maybe I'll get back because that affects 100% of our liabilities, and the rate rising, a smaller percentage of our assets.
Well, I'm sorry. I was going to say, Chris and I were talking the other day about this issue exactly, and I said to him, well, do you think we ought to, you know, look at maybe shortening up on fixed income in ahead of, you know, the rate rises? And he said, no, remember, you've already inoculated your liabilities for that, and that money needs to come to fruition based on the expenses that we're going to have. And I'm like, oh, right.
Your fixed income portfolio is positioned very well for a rate rise. Yeah.
Do you have a sense of what the duration might be yet? I haven't seen it in aggregate.
Oh,
it seems short.
I mean, yeah, it'll be 2 or less.
Yeah. Very short. Okay.
Wait, 2 or less.
Well, in total? Maybe not.
I'm thinking 2% yield. We have a 6-year FFP model. It's probably 3 or less.
Okay.
We might have some of those statistics. We don't. We'll get those statistics. We'll fill that out.
So, right. Ed, I know growth was highly sought after during the rapid rise of the markets.
I'm sorry, what was
growth stock?
Oh, yes.
So now it's going to depend on how fast the 10-year moves to, let's say, 3.5%. If it, you know, gets there by the end of the year, I think the market's okay. If it gets there by August, I think that's not baked in.
Yeah.
So value stocks will start. I think they're already starting to come back into favor a little bit.
They should. There's been a real disparity in performance
right
there. And I think when we look at the markets and say, it's not a just buy everything, it's now be selective. That generally puts more of a focus on the valuation side of the equation, where people are scrutinizing that a bit more. And also looking for yield more, because as you have the tick up in the short term, you tend to see investors prefer the yielding stocks. We think that could make an interesting story. Maybe that's the idea we bring to you. for MLPs. We've heard a lot more discussion about MLP. Master Limited Partnerships are a play on the energy industry in terms of transport, and they generally tend to be higher yielding investment strategies, and we think that that could be an area that gets more attention going forward. There are some other assumptions built into that, but it doesn't mean it's a foolproof investment idea.
But I think interest rates going up is good for us.
I would agree.
Especially if the 10-year gets around 4%, I think we're going to be sitting pretty good.
All day long.
I mean, even if you look at our liquidity portfolio, the immunization of the shortfalls, it's going to be a heck of a lot cheaper this year to fund those shortfalls than it was last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, in a few months when we come to you guys to give you the assessment of the program, we'll talk about this and talk about if you guys want to throw more money at that, immunize farther out because the interest rates are going up, and it's cheaper to insure our liabilities now. That was kind of the whole impetus behind this program, was to maintain an awareness of interest rates and the impact of those interest rates on the cost of our liabilities, and it's happening sooner than what we thought.
Let's jump ahead to page... We'll touch quickly on 14.
Yeah.
The international story continues to unfold very favorably. So where the U.S. is doing well and the stock market is doing well, the dollar is not. The dollar is getting weaker. Basically, when Trump was announced as the president, there was an immediate run-up in the dollar. And since then, it has really trickled down throughout the course of 17 and into 18. And part of it is this page. If we take a look on the right-hand side, we're seeing some real economic growth around the world. Western Europe at 2.5% with an inflation of 1.6 and an unemployment of 7.4. Those numbers are significantly improved, and they have more improvement to go there. Japan having a positive GDP is really nice given their demographics of the aging population. And so they really, are pretty amazing. They're able to generate a positive number at all. The BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, in aggregate, and then broken out. You can see some of those economic growth rates and unemployments and inflation. A really nice combined global story here. So it's certainly not just the U.S. And that also gives the market some buoyancy that if the U.S. or any particular country were to come under pressure, the rest of the world is still doing well. And so that's encouraging. And then let's take a quick look at 31. This equity valuations tying into the economic picture around the world. 31 shows a couple charts that help us look at valuations around the world. So glad their economies are doing well. Let's see what their stock markets are doing. And here on the left-hand side, we have forward PE ratios. The top line on the right-hand side is the S&P 500, so you can see that our forward PE ratio is the highest, meaning the price that you pay for a dollar of earnings is about 18. And the MSCI EAFE, the developed markets outside of the U.S., that number is more like 15. And then the emerging markets is still the lowest, closer to 12 or 13, despite their run-up. So that's pretty interesting. Middle chart, similar picture, just with trailing PE ratios. And then the right-hand side, looking at other valuation metrics besides PE, we have price-to-book value, price-to-free cash flow, dividend yield, earnings yield, and they generally paint a similar story. More expensive in the U.S., less expensive in EAFE and emerging markets. So we have an equal allocation within our asset allocation strategy to try to capture some of that dynamic. And then we'll just close by taking a quick look at page 42, benchmark returns for the quarter and for the month. Over left-hand side, we're seeing U.S. equities 6, 7% kind of numbers, Dow Jones Industrials at 11, that's the highest, and the one-year numbers pretty staggering, 21, 22%, 23%, Russell 1000 growth, the winner there, 30%, Russell 1000 value at 13.7, so Darren, to your point, there's the growth value story playing out. Down below that, international equity slightly higher, 5, 6, and 7% for the quarter. And then year to date, you're seeing in the 30s, even high 30s in a couple cases with emerging markets. Upper right-hand side, fixed income, doing what we expected to do, positive returns, but nothing particularly noteworthy there. And then down below, various other indices for commodities, REITs, leveraged loans, emerging market debt, hedge funds, currencies, all of that good stuff. So, pretty good quarter. I would take four of those in here, that's for sure. And the update in January is, January was more of the same. In fact, all of the markets, as you kind of look at a chart that continues to go up, it hit January and then it just went asymptotic, or exponential, it really went up until February and then it came back down. So where we stand now is actually slightly positive with the S&P 500. So despite the year-to-date number having gone up and come back down, it's still in positive territory. If we turn behind tab two, take a quick look at the plan. Page one, unless there are any questions on markets. Okay, behind tab two, taking a look at the plan, starting the quarter at $2.045 billion, with investment more than offsetting the cash outflows, so ending at $2.11 billion as of December 31st. If we turn ahead to page three, our asset allocation, we have a couple of no's in the right-hand column of this table in the upper right-hand side, and those no's are always interesting because it means we're outside of policy range, and so we want to make sure we're addressing those. You can see the U.S. equity large cap is the overweight. We have 31.2% here. Policy range maximum is 23. Taking Jackson Square's allocation out of that with the funding of AQR will bring that down right about to 23, 24, something in that neighborhood. So it'll put us right on the cusp. And then I think with the real estate rebalancing, there might be another opportunity to bring that closer in line as well. And that will also adjust then the risk parity underweight that is below target. So both of those are being addressed. And so I think maybe the temporary issue there. On page four, taking a look at our performance on the gross of fees basis to compare with other plans, gross of fees, so apples to apples, we have our total fund at 3.6 for the quarter, beating the policy index, was at 3.3, and ranking right about the median of the investor force peer group at 54th percentile. Fiscal year to date, 7.3, also around median, and then you can see the longer term track record, strong 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, and 10 year. 10-year is the only one below our actuarial assumed rate of return. So that's good to see because that 10-year still does include 2008, and that'll start to roll off, and we'll see that look a little bit differently. As we look down the column, we had some underperformance with U.S. equities and U.S. fixed income and real estate and direct lending. So really the only outperformance we got was from infrastructure and from international equities. So you turn ahead to page six, we have the risk analysis. So here we have annualized return over the last 5 years, net of fees of 9.44%. Two columns over, annualized standard deviation of 5.75, both way lower than we would expect, so the market has been very kind to us with low volatility and higher returns. And you can see how that compares then graphically in the charts below. Then as we take a look at the individual investment strategies beginning on page seven, just a couple notes. Jackson Square had some underperformance with specific holdings in Celgene, Symantec, Allergan, and TripAdvisor. So that's what really led to its underperformance there. And 3.4 for the quarter, so it still generated a positive return for us, which we like, but obviously lagged its benchmark pretty considerably. And its peers ranking in the 98th percentile. Dodge & Cox, a couple lines below that, underperformed. So we saw that it recaptured a bit in January. Here's the underperformance. So it had specific issues with Sanofi, Sprint, and some of its energy selection, stocks within the energy sector. And then a few lines below that, Fidelity, we had some you take a look at the track record of Fidelity, and it's right along its benchmark, plus or minus. And since we've held it, going back to April of 2006, 4.8 versus 4.2, so it's slightly outperformed there. And then, of course, that's gross of fees. Net of fees, it's a similar story, 4.3 versus 4.2. It's right along the benchmark. The reason I bring this up is that they had a portfolio manager is changing. So Brian Hosley is retiring as of March 31st. They've named Camille Carlstrom as the successor. Camille was the associate portfolio manager on the Japanese growth portion of this fund, so she'll be taking it over. Anytime we see personnel change, it gives us pause, and we want to dig in deeper, so we've asked our research team to take a look at it. I don't have the results of that yet, so if they're substantive, we'll certainly bring them back to you. The only saving grace I can offer is that Fidelity has this kind of model. They have so many PMs, and they rotate them so regularly across their strategies that they are a firm designed to handle this probably better than most. We would like more notice than March 31st and being told in January, so that's not ideal. But we'll pay attention to it. I think for now, we take keep it in mind, take a look at it every quarter, stay in touch with them and see if anything else changes, see how Camille is in the role and get to know that a little bit better before we would initiate any transaction for it. Those are the only comments I had on the investment strategies. If we go ahead to page 11, or on the publicly traded strategies, page 11 has the progression for the closed-end funds in terms of them calling capital and returning capital to us. The only point I'll make here is that we now have most of these strategies are over 50% call, and so we haven't really taken any action here since 2015 in terms of initiating new positions. I think through all the education sessions we've done with you, the private equity, private debt markets are things that we tend to look at as long-term commitments and build the programs, maintain the programs. So I think this is just part of the reason why staff will be coming back to you in March with recommendations moving forward in some way there. And then skipping ahead to page 14 is your fees. So total plan expenses right around 28 basis points. Of course, staff has more detailed fee analysis that you see regularly on that.
Questions for you?
Are you done?
Yes, sir.
Any board member questions? Rick, are you doing the next item?
Yeah, we're going to get Graham on the phone.
Okay.
So this is item 8A. This is the 2017 actuarial evaluation. It is a discussion and action item, and staff's recommendation would be to accept the June 30th, 2017 actuarial evaluation as presented. And just a reminder, we had Graham here a couple months ago. We talked somewhat in depth about the actuarial evaluation, and you sent him back to finalize the evaluation with no changes, so there shouldn't be a whole lot to this.
Actual evaluation as of June 30th, 2017. What we're going to try to do is answer three basic questions, which are, you know, where are we, how did you get here, and where are you going to be going forward? As part of the evaluation, our primary purpose is...
Sorry.
Something accurate to the plan. We have Chiron.
Your voice is talking over the presentation.
Oh, primary purpose of the evaluation.
Do you have a way to mute that?
Maybe.
Let me see.
What are the assets and liabilities of the system? What are the implied...
I thought it was muted over here.
Okay, I'll just put the volume to zero. It's
okay.
Fine. Yeah, thanks.
All right, thanks. You don't need to hear two of me. I mean, I could just leave the room and just let it go. All right, so the primary purpose of what we're trying to do is to measure, describe, and identify a few things, the assets and the liabilities of the system. Really, the most important thing is what are the employers and the employee contribution rates for the next fiscal year, which is 18-19. And then what are the past and expected future trends in these measurements? Where do we think things are going? So just a very brief summary in terms of what happened last year to this year. Contribution rates are relatively flat, at least due to the experience that happened during 2016 and 2017. You are seeing the rates increase, however, as a result of the phase-in of some prior assumption changes from 2015. It's the last of the three-year phase-in. And then the funded ratio, at least on a market basis, improved considerably as a result of the positive investment experience. But just going into the sort of where are we right now snapshot as of June 30th, 2017, first in looking at the assets, liabilities, and the funded status, as of June 30th, the liabilities were about $2.65 billion. And remember, the actuarial liability is basically your funding target. So it's not a number that you owe to anybody right now. It's the amount of assets you'd like to have on hand to cover the liabilities for your retirees and for your actives, at least for the service that they've earned to date. The assets were just under $2 billion, or just about 75% of the liability number, which is up from 69.1%. This is the market value of assets. It's not the smooth asset rate value that you sometimes refer to. We generally refer to the market value when we're talking about funded ratio, and that aligns with the changes in the GASB statements that were made a few years ago. We really focus on this market value number as opposed to the smooth value when it comes to the funded ratio. And then the unfunded liability is about $675 million, which is about 2.5 times your projected pay for fiscal years 17-18. And remember that the unfunded liability is just the difference between your funding target and your assets. Our valuation report also breaks down all of these results between the county and the series and other special districts. So in our report, you will see the split between those numbers in liability and asset terms. Next, we get into the contribution rates. And remember, our contribution rates are made up of three pieces. There's first the piece that covers the administrative expenses, which is less than 1% of pay. The UAL payment, which is the unfunded liability payment, so it's the payment, the financing payment to pay down that difference between the assets and liabilities. And for the plan as a whole, it averages about 19% of pay this year. And then you've got the normal cost. So that's the portion of the cost assigned to the benefits that are earned this year by the active members. It's about 21.5% of pay. That's offset by the member contributions, which average 9.75%. So that remainder of about 11.8% is the employer's normal cost. We show calculated contribution rates within the report for each of the different groups: county general, county safety, series and special districts, general, series and special district safety. You'll note that the general rates are lower than the safety rates. They have a lower normal cost and a lower UAL payment. And then our evaluation report breaks down all those calculations for the various groups. We also show it for each individual tier of benefits. In terms of plan demographics, you had about 4,300 active employees, which increased by about 60 over the prior year. You have about 1,071 deferred members, so those are members that are deferred some kind of a future benefit but are no longer working from Stansera. And then you have 3,746 retirees in pay status, so that would include your service retirees, disabled members, and beneficiaries. Now, the number of retirees increased faster than the number of actives, so the ratio of the retired to active membership did go up from just under 86% to just under 87%. And projected fiscal year payroll increased by about 2.3%, $3,000. We assume that payroll is going up by 3%, so because it increased by less than that, we do see a slight increase in the contribution rate as a result, but we'll get into that in a minute. So that sort of sums up the calculations in terms of where we are now. How did we get here? We want to talk about what changed in the last year and then how trends changed over time. In terms of the last year, Table 1-4 in the report includes a reconciliation of the cost from last year to this year. First off, we had about a 3% of pay increase, not for things that happened this year, but because of the phase-in of the prior assumption changes. So that brings us up to the rate of 31.95%. That was the full rate last year if you didn't have the phase-in. You did have a drop in the contribution rate as a result of the asset returns. So the assets returned about 14.4% on a market basis. Remember, we use five-year smoothing, so a portion of that gain from this year is deferred for future years, as are a portion of the prior losses and gains. So we had an 8.3% smooth rate of return, which is still greater than your assumption of 7.25%, so you did see a reduction in the contribution rate. We had an increase of about a 0.5% of pay, and that's due to the contribution that was actually received being less than the full actuarial costs, and that's for two reasons. One, there's a 12-month delay in the implementation of these rates. Remember, we're doing a 7/1/17 valuation, but this is determining the contributions for fiscal year 18/19. Plus, you were contributing less than the full actuarial costs last year because of the phase-in of those assumption changes. You did have some gains on demographics, mostly as a result of salaries being less than expected for returning members, because your amortization payment is being spread out as a level percentage of pay, and pay didn't go up as much as you anticipated. You did see a small increase of about 0.17% because of the payroll just not growing as fast as expected, and then a very small change due to some programming changes. So overall, you saw your costs go up, but not as much as they would have been last year. It's still lower than what the contribution rate was last year, notwithstanding the phase-in of those assumption changes, dropping from 31.95 to 31.65. And then we break down in the VAL report, splitting that cost into the various components, the normal cost, the amortization, and the administrative expenses. In terms of what's happened historically, is this animation showing for you live? Are you seeing?
Yes.
Okay. So this is just showing what's happened to the contribution rates from 2011 to 2017. Started around 18% of pay, and they climbed pretty significantly, especially from 2014 to 15 when we had that experience study where we made a lot of assumption changes. But here what we're showing is the actual rate that's been charged with phase-in, so you can see how, as a result of those policies, the employers had more chance to build in those contribution increases over a more smooth period. You've also got the employees' contribution rates, which have hovered around 10% of pay over the last few years. Those have increased slightly as a result of the assumption changes and the change to the PEPR membership, but because the PEPR members have lower normal costs, even though they may be paying a higher percentage of the cost, their normal costs aren't expected to increase that much because their benefits are lower. Right now, the normal cost, the employee contribution for the general members is, I believe, 8% of pay for the county and about 8.5% of pay for series in the special districts. For the safety members, I believe that rate is 13%. Okay, so moving forward, we also have the history of the funded status. And you can
Graham.
Again over the last seven years.
Graham?
Graham, we have a question.
Graham, I have a question on your last slide. Is the expected employer contribution rate, which has been going up, right? Is that expected to keep climbing? Because you stopped it at 2017.
On our next section, we're going to get into the where are you going section, and that's where we're showing that, no, we're not anticipating significant continued increases in the contribution rate, assuming your assumptions are met. So we'll get there in just a second, but that's our next set of slides. So in terms of what's happened historically, historically on your assets and liabilities, you can see there was that big jump from 2014 to 2015 in the liability when it jumped from just over $2 billion to about $2.4 billion. Again, that was when we implemented those more conservative investment and mortality assumptions. We also are showing the smooth asset value, and now we're showing the market value of assets. So you can see the smooth out value is really doing exactly what it's intended to do. That's a much smoother line than the ups and downs in the market value. And so that helps even out some of the ups and downs in the contribution rates for the employers. Okay, so getting over to your question about where are we expected to be going, what's expected to happen in the future and what are the risks. Our report does show a projection of the contribution rate based on the baseline assumption that you're going to earn exactly 7.25% each year. As part of this presentation, we've also done a stochastic analysis or a Monte Carlo simulation. So we've simulated the returns based on your 7.25% assumed earnings rate, and then we assume a 10% standard deviation of returns, and then we did a Monte Carlo simulation and recreated what would happen to the contribution rate in each of those 25 different 100 scenarios, and from that we create these confidence intervals. So you can see that in that middle 20% of the distribution in year 2032, we're looking at something between 18% and about 40% of pay for that sort of middle 20th percentile of the distribution. And again, this might, hopefully this answers your question about what do we expect the contribution rates to be. We expect them to be very flat, at least for the next 10 years, if your assumptions are met.
Right.
Slight decline in the rates as you have your PEPRA members coming into the plan, right, because they're going to have a lower normal cost of benefits. But overall, we don't have any big prior investment gains or losses that we still have to recognize. We're not phasing any additional assumption changes at this point. The positive returns from this year kind of counteracted the negative returns from the last couple of years. So at this point, we expect the rates to be pretty flat unless you have some big experience changes or assumption changes. Mike, does that answer your question?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right, we perform a similar simulation on the funded status of the plan. So again, we're looking from 2017 out to 2031. I think we actually show it out a full 20 years in the valuation report where we show the projection going forward. You can see by the end of the period, we're expecting that median funded ratio to be back up into the 90s. And if you go out a few more years, you would see it back up to 100%. Which makes sense given that the amortization policy calls for you to amortize that unfunded liability over the, over the next, I believe it's 20 years. Sorry, 19 years left in the amortization period. So again, we show a distribution of those funded ratios based on the simulation of the asset returns. And again, you can see that it's, there's a lot of variability in those funded ratios. You'll notice that there's sort of a hard floor down there in the, mid to upper 50s, that you don't see the funded ratio go below that. Well, that's because if you got your funded ratio, pretty low, what would happen is the contributions would have to increase significantly, and that sort of keeps the funded ratio from going down much below the mid-50s. Now, that is, that assumes that the sponsor can actually continue to make those contributions, even if they're at a very high level. So there is an assumption in here that the county and other sponsors will actually make those contributions. That's what keeps that, the funded ratio from falling too low. Okay, moving along. In terms of what's actually in the valuation report, in addition to the stuff that we've summarized, you have a full book that should be in front of you. Sorry if we give you the bound copies in time for this, but we can provide additional copies. We have things like the changes in the market value of assets. We show the full calculation of the actuarial smoothing. So how does that smooth value of assets get calculated? And at this point, what you can see is the ratio of the actuarial to the smooth value to the market value is really close. It's 99.7%. So at this point, you only have about just under $6 million in deferred gains that you have yet to recognize. We also show the breakdown of the liabilities into all the various groups between general safety, series, and the county. We show a gain loss calculation in terms of what's happened with the investment experience, you know, with the asset and liability experience over the past year. Why did the funded status change? As I said before, we break the contribution rates down into all the different tiers. And then we also have information in the appendices about your membership, so how many active employees in each group, what's their average age, service, and so forth. We show what our assumptions are in the report, so what are the expected rates of retirement, mortality, etc. We have a summary of plan provisions, which also includes tables showing you for each of those different tiers what the benefit formulas are. And then we also show what the member contribution rates are for each group. So that really sums up what's in that book, the valuation report, and the key results. Of course, here's my little joke. We'd be remiss if we didn't show you the fine print. Has all the disclaimers. It's about as fine as I can make it. But I'm happy to answer any other questions on the valuation report.
So, Graham, I have a question. This is Mandeep Dhillon. When is our next experience study to be conducted?
We're on tap for this year.
For this year. Do you foresee any major changes from the last time you did this?
So, you know, the discount rate is something that you always talk about, right? You know, in terms of if you made any changes in terms of your investment policies, your asset allocation, or if the expectations from your investment consultant has changed significantly. Now, I know that just in having worked with Ferris and other investment consultants, a lot of them have reduced their expectations for, you know, for their capital market assumptions. So a lot of the plans that I work with are talking about additional reductions in their discount rate. You know, a number of plans in the last year have adopted, you know, or are targeting something like a 7% return. I do know that there is, I think there's at least one 37-MAC county that's gone down to 6.75%. But most plans are still at 7.25%, just with a growing number at 7%. So that's something that you'll always, you know, always want to pay attention to. In terms of the other assumptions, you know, we've done a lot of work with you and our clients in terms of things like the generational mortality assumptions. And what the data has shown sort of U.S.-wide is that mortality improvements haven't been happening as fast as expected in a lot of the population. So for at least the clients that I've been working with recently, I have not seen big increases in costs as a result of mortality changes. That may not be true for other systems if they haven't already updated these generational tables, but you did this the last time around. So I wouldn't expect to see a big increase in your costs as a result of mortality unless your experience in particular has been pretty different from everyone else's. And I'm not really seeing any other assumption changes. You know, most of my clients haven't been making big other changes in terms of things like retirement and termination behavior.
Okay, Graham, Mr. Rick. Any discussions on inflation?
You know, a lot of people are continuing to bring it down by 25 basis points or more. Most plans that were above 3 have gotten down to that 3% level. Some of the plans, you know, people that are at 3 are thinking whether or not they bring it down under 3 to something like 2.75 or even 2.5. You know, the investment consultants are generally still expecting something like 2.25 or 2.5% as their sort of long-term expectation. But then, you know, I'm sure your trustees read reports and hear things about, you know, increases in CPI and increases in wage growth that have happened recently. So I haven't heard anything that's causing investment consultants to really reconsider their long expectations to bring those back up to like a 3% level. I'm still hearing something like the 2.5% range. So most of the public plans that I work with have been sort of slowly and steadily ratcheting that assumption down.
Okay, thanks.
Graham, one other question. Just for my educational purposes, is there a relationship between the retirees as the number of retirees increase? to the discount rate? Because will that become inverse at some point, or how does that play out?
So with an open and ongoing plan, I don't expect that it has a big impact on your discount rate, right? To the extent that, StanSara, you know, stays as an open plan and new members join the plan, what that means is that your time horizon for your investments, while it's not infinite, at least is pretty far out into the future, right? You're going to need to keep on paying benefits for decades as long as you keep stable as an open plan. I do have some plans where they are closed to new entrants. For instance, there's an Oakland Police and Fire plan that's been closed for about 20 years, and all of the members are now retired. Actually, it's been closed for longer than that. And their liabilities are, the duration of their liabilities is not very long. They expect to pay, you know, the majority of their benefits out within the next 10 years. So they're expecting to start, they're going to start moving towards a much more conservative asset allocation, where they're going to be basically just buying bonds to match the expected cash flows. And as a result of that, they are anticipating pretty big reductions in their discount rate going forward.
Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thanks.
Any other questions for Graham? Graham, good job, as always.
Okay, thanks, and look forward to seeing you guys at Calipers or Sackers or somewhere else.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Do we have to do something? Do we have to take an action?
Discussion action. Okay. To accept the 2017 actual evaluation.
Is there...
I just commented that the technology worked good today.
Okay.
I'll make a motion to accept the June 30th, 2017 actuarial valuation as presented.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Is there discussion? Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Passed unanimously. Next item is the information update.
And this will be presented by Natalie Elliott.
Okay, we have completed phase 4C of the user acceptance testing module, which is the members module of the system, which includes all the members' demographics, their contribution, salary, and their service. Although the testing has been completed, we still have a few more little tests to do because there were some bugs found that were fixed and pushed back out to us. So once we get that done, phase 4 will be done. We received a new release for the imaging production piece of it, which is our electronic document piece. All that's been tested and sent back, and that's went into production last Friday. And we began implementation of the employer integration piece of it. We have three of the employers that will be uploading their data into our system, and we have pushed out the file specification, the import file specification document to them for their review and questions and concerns, and we'll be meeting with them on March 13th to go over those. So we're on track, we're on schedule, and we're on budget.
Okay, and you don't need any motions from us today.
Pardon me?
You don't need any action from us?
No, I don't.
Okay. Kelly, are you doing the next one?
I am. Next item is 8C. This is the Sackers 2018 Spring Business Meeting. So basically today what I'm asking for is your first proxy and your alternate proxy to be able to vote in May at the business meeting on the last day on Friday. But they have also given you an opportunity to see the deadlines for nominating someone for the new board and how that process will work. And then your business packet will come hopefully in the April meeting to be able to vote to tell your proxies how you want to vote. So today I'm just asking who your two proxies you would like them to be.
Isn't it always Darren and Mike? Yeah, Michael Neal.
She's the who's going here for the meeting.
You're being told.
Well, I mean, let's do O'Neill because he's not here.
To be honest, I don't know if Mike will be there for the last day. He's also going to be going to another training directly from there, NC PERS. So he said absolutely if he was needed, he could try to delay, you know, leaving out for that. But if there was somebody else available, it would make it easier for his travel. For right now, I have Darren attending and Mike Lynch, are you attending?
What is it, wasn't there a conflicting one?
Yeah, you're going to go to NC PERS.
Where
correct?
Is that one?
That one is in New York.
Yeah, that's the one that we should not probably miss.
Should not.
But I'll attend, unless there's a conflict, I don't mind.
Yeah, and if we don't have any other trustees, you know, we might have staff available to, you know, be the alternate proxies. We've done that in the past. Darren, are you willing to stay?
I don't mind. It's pretty painless.
So you're in?
I don't think I have a choice.
All right. I move that Darren become the guy.
And then we need an alternate?
It would be Mike. The other Mike.
Okay.
And I can be third alternate if necessary.
Yeah. Okay,
I'll second the
motion.
Thank you.
Motion is to appoint Darren and Mike as an alternate and Rick as a third alternate to the SACRS conference. All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone oppose? Motion carries unanimously.
Thank you.
And let's do members forum before we go to closed session, because we have an item in closed session that
we do.
Yeah, it will require one of the board members to leave. So. Jim, why don't you head off?
I didn't get my board packet till Monday, so the staff had to print like 200 pages Friday for me to take home, so if we could make an effort to get it Friday. If it's a problem, we could even send somebody over to pick it up.
We did have a problem with delivery. It wasn't staff generating it here or it getting done. We did have a little problem with the mail room and actually even mail getting out to the post office, so we recognize that, and I will probably go back to the hand delivery so I can make sure that you get it on time.
We did have it on time in there. It just wasn't delivered.
Yeah, they had some.
It was a county mailroom issue.
Some issues at the other end.
I followed up with my staff, and that's where we dropped the ball.
Oh, okay. Well, I just wanted to bring that up because they had that print of 200 pages. Because
yeah.
I need it over the weekend, but for the amount of material in here, I just can't pick it up. You know, Monday.
Yeah, we didn't
ready
know
Tuesday.
Until Monday that it didn't get to you, or else we've been in the past driven out and dropped it off to you. So we're willing to do what we need to do, and we'll just go back to making sure that we're in charge of getting it to you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's all I have.
I don't have it either.
I don't have it.
Nothing here.
Nothing?
Nothing.
Nope.
Not for me.
I have nothing.
Nothing.
I just like to point out that the meeting is much quicker since I've become chair.
such efficiency.
We need a motion to go into closed session.
Motion. So move. Or I'll second it.
And let's give everyone a couple minutes to get out of the room who aren't going to be in.
See you all then.
Yeah.
Oh.
Thank you, Mike.
You're certainly authority there.
I move you adjourned.
Second.
there is no report from closed session. Does the board desire to adjourn if you want to talk for a long time?
Call for the question.
Motion to adjourn and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Thank you.